wish I could share.
This is Stephanie Wells, Executive Director of Pacifica Foundation. Congress has defunded public media, threatening the survival of television and radio stations that provide trusted news, emergency alerts, and vital community connection. Years of corporate media consolidation and deregulation have taken media out of community hands, while social media platforms cut back on fact-checking, leaving communities vulnerable to misinformation. In this time of social crisis and climate emergencies, local stations provide vital information for keeping our community safe. You can help by supporting and donating to your local community media. This message comes to you in solidarity from the Pacifica Foundation.
You rely on KPFK for the voices and perspectives you just don't find anywhere else. Now we're asking you to become a key part of KPFK's future. We're on a mission to bring in 500 new sustaining members in our fall fund drive, which starts this coming Tuesday, September 23rd. Your ongoing support as a sustaining member for as little as $5 a month helps us to get there. It's the easiest and most powerful way to make your commitment, providing the reliable funding the station needs to stay strong. Please join our fall fund drive for 500 new members today at kpfk.org/donate. Thank you and welcome.
KPFK, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. The Trump administration is putting the weight of the federal government behind a crackdown on political speech it deems objectionable in the aftermath of the murder of Charlie Kirk. But Trump's crackdown began before this assassination, clamping down on free speech, with the head of the FCC threatening to pull licenses of companies like Disney, who own ABC, is an ominous escalation. But we've already seen constitutional violations with ICE detentions and deportations, and have watched Trump extort universities, law firms, and more. Today, we turn to the Supreme Court, the Department of Justice, and the accelerating erosion of democratic guardrails under Donald Trump. Pema Levy of Mother Jones has tracked the Supreme Court's radical empowerment of Trump, and she joins us. Pema's reporting shows how the Roberts Court landmark decision in Trump v. United States didn't just grant Trump immunity from prosecution for his official acts. It armed him with the ability to wield the Justice Department as a personal weapon against political rivals. We've seen investigations launched against critics, making the DOJ look now more like the president's private legal firm. To help us make sense of this convergence of legal rulings, authoritarian practices, and their impact on democracy, we're really fortunate to have Pema Levy with us today. All this when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we turn to the Supreme Court, the Department of Justice, and the accelerating erosion of democratic guardrails under Donald Trump. Pema Levy of Mother Jones has tracked the Supreme Court's radical empowerment of Trump, and she joins us. Pema's reporting shows how the Roberts Court landmark decision in Trump v. United States didn't just grant Trump immunity from prosecution for his official acts. It armed him with the ability to wield the Justice Department as a personal weapon against political rivals. Trump has extended this power to silence dissent in the cultural sphere, pressuring ABC to fire late-night comedian Jimmy Kimmel for mocking him and threatening to revoke TV licenses of networks that air critical coverage. Corporations are complying rather than fight, for the most part. And then there's the court's greenlighting of racial profiling raids in L.A. with ICE agents targeting people for how they look, speak, or where they work, undermining the Fourth Amendment, as Justice Sotomayor warned. Pema Levy is joining us. She's a reporter at Mother Jones. She was previously the Washington correspondent for Newsweek, covering Congress elections and court battles. She's also worked with the International Business Times, Talking Points Memo, and the American Prospect. Well, let me just begin. Thank you for joining us today, Pema, with something that I just saw that Erwin Chemerinsky wrote. He is a constitutional scholar and dean of Berkeley Law. He recently talked about who could challenge the Trump administration, or to challenge, for that matter, any totalitarian-leaning or authoritarian-leaning government. One group is the lawyers, and Trump has gone after law firms for the sake of revenge. Another is the press, and we've seen how he's gone after the press and how some have caved. And we've also seen how Trump has targeted universities, another source that could possibly check and criticize his actions. And that leaves the courts. Chemerinsky says specifically judges in the courts. Trump and his appointees are not going to voluntarily comply with the Constitution, apparently, nor is Congress. So Chemerinsky says it has to be the courts. And he emphasized that if there's going to be any guardrails of democracy upheld, it's going to be judges in the courts. So that brings us, Pema Levy, to your recent article in Mother Jones. It's called "The Supreme Court Greenlit the President's Political Prosecutions, Even Unlawful Ones," and you can find it online at motherjones.com. So I want to welcome you to the show and just start out immediately with the Trump v. U.S. ruling. Explain what it is, please.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having me. As I think listeners will remember, on July 1st, 2024, the Supreme Court issued its decision, written by Chief Justice John Roberts in Trump versus United States. And this was the case about whether or not the Justice Department could prosecute Trump for his attempt to steal the 2020 election. And President Trump's lawyers, he was then an ex-president, had put forth an argument that had really never been accepted before, which was that former presidents are immune from criminal prosecution for official acts. And to, I think, the surprise of a lot of people, the Roberts Court went along with this. And they said, yes, former presidents are immune, broadly immune from criminal liability for most official acts, and absolutely immune from liability for what they called acts within the president's core powers, what they also call conclusive and preclusive authority. So that's the main headline, right? That's the takeaway last July, which is it's going to be really hard to prosecute Trump for his attempts to steal the election. What a lot of people missed, and what academics have started to look into, and what I think the Trump administration's lawyers very much realize, is that the opinion actually went much further than that. And it actually expanded the sphere of core presidential powers, things that are conclusively and preclusively the president's powers. And it expanded them significantly to basically greenlight illegal conduct. And that includes illegal prosecutions. You know, if the president wants to tell people to fabricate evidence, and by people, I mean prosecutors, if the president wants to tell prosecutors, federal prosecutors, to fabricate evidence, to lie to a judge, to do whatever it takes to, you know, prosecute this individual, the president is not liable for breaking the law. And arguably, neither are the prosecutors that would go ahead and perpetrate that fraud.
I think you call this the loaded weapons that this decision gave the court. Was it the case, I want to go more into it, but was it the case, do you think, that the decision in the immediate aftermath was underestimated or not understood? It's a loaded weapon, and I think I'm really asking this question because I don't think that people, they understood the immunity part, and they were thinking of prosecution of Trump, for things that he would do in breaking the Constitution or, for example, trying to overthrow the election. But you're saying it goes a lot farther than that.
Yeah. There's a really deep irony to this decision, which is that purportedly the logic of this decision is that a president cannot act with energy and vigor and, you know, execute the office as the framers intended if they are sort of constantly under this shadow of, will I be prosecuted later for my actions? And during oral arguments, Justice Samuel Alito brought this up, basically saying, like, we can't have this era where, like, prosecutors, you know, untrustworthy prosecutors just start going after former presidents. Like, we can't have this. We have to, you know, stop that. Well, ironically, what this decision actually greenlit was just that, was prosecutions possibly untethered from reality, but certainly coming from a point of, you know, political expediency, desire for revenge, desire to discredit and even jail one's political opponents. So it literally did what it said it was not going to do.
And everything's moving so, you know, fast and furious. And so it seems like it's very easy to be so overwhelmed that we forget these really important cases that have come before us since that ruling. And I'd like you to just sort of go over very quickly, if you can, the way that Trump, for example, authorized, the raid of Bolton's house and going after Schiff and Letitia James, Brennan Comey. It's all, you know, about what he said, retribution and revenge. But he's empowered the Justice Department to allow him to do that, and he hasn't empowered it. You're saying that the Roberts Court allowed this to happen.
Yeah, it gets a little complicated. Okay. But here's the gist of it. The Justice Department is a part of the executive branch that the president does oversee to some degree. There is a longstanding norm that really goes back, like, to the beginning of the Justice Department in 1870, that you need a separation between, you know, the partisan politics of the president and how prosecutors function and how they, you know, enforce the law, because you don't want the law to become a political weapon. That's not how a democracy works. So you have this norm, you know, moving into the Trump era, of separation. And you have, you know, policies of, you know, limited contacts between the White House and the Justice Department. And all of that is gone now, where now the president basically says, yeah, I could order a raid on John Bolton. I can order a prosecution of this person. I can do this, and no problem. So the norm is gone. And what's more, because of the Supreme Court's decision in Trump versus United States, it makes the norm seem completely outmoded, because Roberts literally wrote in that opinion that the attorney general is not the nation's chief law enforcement officer. The attorney general is the president's law enforcement officer. It completely reoriented the Justice Department essentially as the lawyers for the president, not the lawyers for the country. And I think the starkest illustration that you're seeing, I literally, before I got on this call with you, got a breaking news alert about it from the New York Times, is President Trump is pushing prosecutors to indict Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, for mortgage fraud. And the prosecutors in Virginia are saying, we just don't have the evidence that she did anything wrong. And now the prosecutor in Virginia is, I'm just, you know, citing reporting here that I haven't done myself, but this is now the New York Times saying that he's expecting to be fired because he isn't launching this politically motivated prosecution that is not founded in facts. So you already see the beginning of the president on down saying, I want you to go after this person. It doesn't matter if the facts aren't there. It doesn't matter if no crime was committed. Make it happen.
So how does that work, though? So if you have, he's telling a judge to go after them, and if the judge doesn't—
Not a judge, prosecutors in the Justice Department. Yeah.
Okay, so in that case, it makes it very difficult, and that means that he's going to go after Cook as well on the Fed, which we've already seen for the same thing, mortgage fraud. So this is really unusual, and I think, you know, just to let this sink in for our listeners, you've just explained, Pema Levy, the way that this decision literally made the Department of Justice, not the Department of Justice of the United States, but the Department of Justice for the president. And that's something that we saw in the first Trump administration that was not okay, right? When he instructed Barr to go after, I can't even remember at this case what, but Barr said he didn't serve at the pleasure of the president, I believe. Do you remember exactly how that one went on?
I don't remember exactly.
Okay, that's
so,
okay.
It was around January 6th, but yeah. It is true that during Trump's first term, he ran up against the norms that were still guarding the Justice Department. So, you know, there was reporting that he was saying, hold up, you know, antitrust division, hold up these mergers, right? Because I'm mad at Time Warner or I'm mad at CNN, right? So there were examples of the president trying to inject himself and you know, effectively doing so in terms of the antitrust division. And then certainly, you know, what this entire case came out of was the president going to the Justice Department and trying to use them to steal the election. And you had, you know, Attorney General Barr and then his, the Jeffrey Rosen, I can't remember, don't quote me on the name, I'm blanking on the name. But anyways, his successor telling Trump, like, no, we'll resign, we'll walk away, everyone will walk away, we're not going to do it. Well, this time around, he put Pam Bondi in that spot. He put Todd Blanche, his former personal attorney, as her deputy, right? So he put people in the Justice Department who were like, yeah, we'll do that. He has this guy, Ed Martin, who is running a, you know, weaponization task force, which is supposed to be looking into weaponization, but is actually just a tool of weaponization, who's overseeing these mortgage fraud investigations into Senator Schiff, Lisa Cook from the Federal Reserve Board, and Letitia James. So you have a situation where all the people that normally would have said, hey, we don't do it this way, they're gone. And the people he put in place are like, yeah, we'll do what you want.
I think I also just saw as a news headline that Trump has asked the Supreme Court to allow him to go ahead and fire Lisa Cook of the Federal Reserve, which is supposed to be an independent body. Given everything that you've just said, what do you expect that's going to, how will that turn out?
You know what? That is a really good question. And here's what I'm going to say about it. If it was any other agency, I would say the Supreme Court will uphold that firing. Will uphold that removal as the case moves forward. You know, if it was the any other independent agency, I have no doubt that Lisa Cook would be gone. I think the Fed is a really tricky situation, and the Supreme Court knows that. So literally a few months ago, in a separate opinion over the firing of two members of independent commissions, the Supreme Court said, yeah, you can go ahead and remove them for now, you know, that's fine. But the Federal Reserve is different. And it sort of came up with it, said it's a quasi-private entity with a unique history, blah, blah, blah. Okay, whatever that means. And they did that, I am pretty sure, because the entire economy of the country and the world depends on an independent monetary policy coming from the Fed. Right. And so now the Supreme Court is faced with a choice, right? Like, do you do what your jurisprudence has really pointed to, which is Trump can remove whoever he wants. That's where the Supreme Court has been moving. On the other hand, the economy might really suffer, especially if just the perception, right, that the president can fire members of the Federal Reserve Board if someone finds some thing to accuse them of a crime with. You know, we haven't gotten to the point of like proving a crime. So if all the president has to do is allege a crime and then remove whoever he wants, you don't actually have independence, right? So I think the Supreme Court is in a really tough spot. I think they really have tried to carve out an exception for the Fed. Yeah. And President Trump is going to them and basically saying, were you bluffing?
Right.
And we're going to find out.
Well, I'm really glad you said that, Pema, because this is an extraordinary case. And we don't know, for example, what it would mean if just in this one case, if he's allowed to fire her and put somebody else in, what that will mean for decision making. But certainly it casts a pall. And you would think, although you've just said it very well, that given that so much depends on this, that on the independence of the Fed, that might give the justices some pause, but then they'd have to go back over their previous decision and all the rest of it. So I guess we can only say we'll see what happens, but we're going to see very soon what happens. So I'm really glad that this is a sort of, you know, introduction to the rest of what is in your article, because I wanted to go also, you know, the broader conception of free speech, which is definitely under attack. And the news of the week, of course, is the firing of Jimmy Kimmel for really some pretty bland comments that, you know, no different than any other comedian makes all the time. But in this case, given the atmosphere around the sanctification of Charlie Kirk and the horrendous murdering of him, nobody can be in favor of that. But then, of course, we knew that they would use this to move forward against enemies. And now we see that Trump not only forced ABC Disney to fire Jimmy Kimmel, but now we saw the head of the FCC saying, yeah, we can revoke licenses if you do anything. He didn't say if you do anything we don't like, but essentially said that. So, wow. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's obviously authoritarian and disturbing. One of the things I thought about is a situation just a few years ago where Disney, which obviously has an enormous presence in Florida, criticized the Don't Say Gay bill that was passed there under Governor Ron DeSantis. I don't, probably your listeners recall, but Florida passed a law that was deemed, you know, called Don't Say Gay. And they basically said in Florida classrooms, you can't teach about sexuality or sexual orientation and gender identity. And Florida criticized it. And DeSantis and the Republicans in the legislature said, this is a betrayal. You know, you need to get in line. And as a result, we're going to revoke this special tax status you have that allows you to govern the area where Disney World is. And that was blatant retaliation for free speech, because Disney is a person legally. Right?
All right.
Corporations are people. They have free speech rights. You know, there is a double-edged sword to the idea that corporations are people. A lot of ways, we don't like it. But it also means that corporations have a political voice. Moreover, there is Supreme Court precedent that says, even if the government has granted something special, like a special tax status or a license to broadcast, you can't revoke it because of disfavored speech, right? You could revoke it in a normal way because you've changed your policy, but you cannot revoke even something that has been specially granted as a result of, you know, an attempt to punish speech. So there were free speech grounds, and then there was this, like, you know, Supreme Court precedent over retaliation. And Disney sued. They didn't back down. They went to federal court and they sued, and they said, this is a violation of our rights. And I think what happened in Florida, I don't know. I can't look inside Disney's head. I don't have the sources there. But I think that informed this situation. Because what happened in Florida is, one, they pulled a Trump judge. And the Trump judge sided with DeSantis. And by Trump judge, I mean a Trump-appointed judge, right? They appealed, and that appeal, you know, as it was going on, they basically came to an agreement with DeSantis. DeSantis wanted this feud to end. Disney wanted this feud to end. Everyone just wanted to, like, make money on Disney World and let bygones be bygones. So they just kind of, like, came together and resolved it and dropped the case. And, you know, now, a few years later, here comes Trump and here comes Brendan Carr, and they're violating their free speech rights. They're violating Supreme Court precedent over retaliation. Right? It feels like an absolute replay. And Disney's going, what? Oh, I'm going to stand up to them and I'm going to like go to court. And then, you know, this Supreme Court is ultimately going to be the judge here. And like, I just, you know, it's just better for our bottom line if we make nice. We already did this once and we're going to do it again. Now, the situation is different. This is the president. This is an authoritarian wannabe president. This is not exactly Disney's statement. This is, you know, something that Jimmy Kimmel said on TV. So, you know, it's not like the facts are exactly the same. But I think that corporate America has decided that, like, let's just make nice and let's protect our bottom line. And, you know, I think that the thing that Disney also should have learned is that you can't just make nice and protect your bottom line, because they'll just keep coming and they'll keep coming and they'll keep coming.
And we've learned that over and over again with universities, with, you know, with science, with everything. But I think this is a really important point because, well, it says many things. And I was thinking about this and wishing, you know, McChesney was still alive talking about the corporate takeover of the media, because really now ABC is owned by Disney and there's not that many owners of major media right now. So they have outsized power in this regard. And then on the other hand, the caving, because they're protecting the bottom line and not democracy, is really extraordinary, because had they taken this to court, it would have been a kind of wonderful challenge for the Supreme Court, because it's clearly unconstitutional to curb free speech, even hate speech, you know, and this would have been a test. But I think almost any judge would have thrown it out of court. Do you think that's true? And does that sort of say, well, they're wimps or they don't care? Or
I think that Disney, that ABC had a great case, right? But so did CBS when they were chump sued them about over 60 minutes, right? Yeah. But they wanted a merger and they settled and wrote a check, right? Yeah. And so I think that this is not about the strength of the legal case anymore. I think it's about corporations just deciding that the easiest thing to do is to cave. And, you know, why go through months of litigation if you're just going to cave anyway? So I think that there's unfortunately such an intermingling between corporate ambitions and like journalism right now. And that, look, I actually think everyone would be better off if we didn't have an authoritarian government. So I think everyone probably would benefit in the long run to take this to court and not cave. But the short-term and long-term interests are in conflict right now.
Right. And it is the case. I mean, what we're seeing is corporations rolling over, or rather comply under even minimum intimidation. Maybe it's not quite so minimum, because as you've just said so eloquently, you know, that it's the bottom line that counts, and they just would rather do it because obviously it's not that important, but you would think that it would be. And it would just take, you know, as we saw after Trump went after Columbia, that Harvard didn't cave right away. Now he's going after UC. And we're seeing some fight back. We just have to see where it goes. But when there is a fight, there's a chance, you know. But when they just roll over, then, you know, it's kind of game done. And there's so many other aspects I want to cover about that. But I just want to just say that my own expertise is in the former Soviet Union and now Putin's Russia. And I've watched what they do there. It's much worse. It's much, much worse. Because there, you know, I don't discount that Trump could borrow that playbook as well, which is to come up with the most bizarre and absurd charges, but to actually have these charges allow Putin, for example, to lock up people and then repeatedly keep them locked up for things like discrediting the army or justifying terrorism for a joke or something else, or, you know, anything like that. But I don't know how far away we are from that, especially if Trump can go after Lisa Cook and Letitia James and say it's really about mortgage fraud. It would be interesting if the defense looks up how many people own two homes, you know, or, you know, on both sides of that fence. I don't know, but it's quite ominous, as you say. And I want to just bring in the next case that you've written about and that I've covered here on this show, which is ICE. We're living in Los Angeles. We've seen ICE target not criminals, but workers. And repeatedly, I interviewed on this show the head of the car wash arrows, as they're called here, where they've gone over and over again to some of the same car washes, and they've arrested the workforce. Sometimes they also arrest the owners, and oftentimes car washes are on corners, so they arrest people getting off the bus as well, anybody that they can catch. The ACLU and others have said this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's outright discrimination. And we're seeing that. And I think you've been writing about it as well. So even worse is now we get these cases on the shadow docket where they don't have to actually elaborate on how they came to the decision that they did, but they're allowing ICE to continue to target people who look Latino in Los Angeles. Can you talk a little bit about this and what you found in your reporting?
Yeah. I mean, basically, the district court judge in this case looked at a lot of evidence and said, yeah, this is illegal racial profiling. The Ninth Circuit said, yeah, we're going to keep that decision in place. You know, basically it issued an injunction saying you have to stop doing that. And the Trump administration went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, actually, we're going to let you go ahead and do what you were doing, and we're not going to tell you why. So now, in the Central District of California, Los Angeles, the greater Los Angeles area, ICE can stop people because they look Latino, because they speak English with an accent, and maybe they're also doing something such as waiting for the bus or at a Home Depot, in these basically working class, you know, working poor jobs. And they can target them for those reasons alone. And the thing that I've written a couple of things about it, but one of the things that I wrote about it is what's so dark about this, or a lot of things are. One of the things that's really dark about this is that this is a Supreme Court that says over and over and over again that the government cannot be using race, that this is like the worst thing. Like if a institution that takes federal dollars wants to, you know, give a little bit of preference to someone for a place at Harvard, right? If Harvard wants to give a little bit of like preference for a black applicant, like, no. maybe in an upcoming case, the Supreme Court is going to say, you can't use race to give political power to minority communities when you draw congressional maps or political maps, any political maps. I mean, this court is obsessed with removing considerations of race when it helps racial minorities. And then they turn around and they say, but if the government wants to use race to target racial minorities, we're going to let you do that. And we're not even going to bother to explain why we aren't contradicting ourselves.
I think you said in your article that they can not use race. Universities can't use race in admitting students through affirmative action, but ICE can use race. And they point out this glaring, you know, contradiction, and it isn't picked up. I mean, in general, maybe it is, but you had Sotomayor certainly dissenting from this form of view. Kavanaugh didn't. I guess it's just weird, you know, to see how easily, you know, these constitutional protections and these precedents just mean so little.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it, is you have all this precedent saying one thing, right, and then the court can issue an opinion but it's not an opinion. It's just an order. There's no opinion. Justice Kavanaugh did issue a concurring opinion, so credit to him for attempting to explain why he voted this way. but the court did not speak to why they were doing this. They just did it. And, you know, all of that precedent, all of the words that have come out of their, you know, their pens previously.
Yeah.
Not accounted for.
So that kind of brings us, Pam Levy, to the sort of, I guess, how you see these actions really expanding authoritarian practices, not just in the police, but empowering the Justice Department, and the weakness of the pushback, especially from corporations. But and I think you also wrote about the broader pattern with connections to what, you know, we've seen other authoritarian leaders do in building up these kind of prosecutions, weaponizing, as we've seen and we've discussed on this program, weaponizing anti-Semitism to go after protests and everything else. So how do you, I guess, overall assess what the court is doing in its, let's call it, weak concurrences? And maybe you could talk a little bit, too, about some heroic judges that aren't doing this, but then what's the effect of that?
Yeah, I mean, when I think about what the Supreme Court is doing recently, it is deciding again and again that the most important thing is that the president gets to do what he wants. And whether or not that violates people's rights or violates the law or violates the Constitution is less important. And so again and again, you see, oh, the president wants to fire someone, even though there's a law against that, no problem. The president wants to target Latinos, even though there's a law, the Constitution says you can't do that, no problem. The president wants to deport people to far-flung dangerous countries, even though there's a statute and international treaties that say you can't do that, go ahead, right? So again and again and again, they're basically saying, you know, what the president wants comes first, and then the law and the Constitution come second. And that's not how democracies work, because democracies have to run on the rule of law. The law has to rule, right? And so, you know, in case after case, the Supreme Court is saying, no, the laws are not ruling, at least at this time. It's the president that gets to go ahead and do this. And so when you see that happening again and again, that makes you question the integrity of our democracy. And I think the last thing to point out on that part of your question is that the people who are harmed are the unpopular, right? The immigrants, people of color, people without resources to hire lawyers. And so I think, as is consistent with a lot of authoritarian turns, everyone is not equally targeted. Everyone is not equally feeling what is happening, but certain disfavored populations are.
Right, and there's not a lot of protection either. Or, I mean, there's certainly public outrage here in Los Angeles, there's public outrage elsewhere, but we're not seeing it on a national level to the extent that we could, or even making the parallels to, you know, obvious things like fascism. But even so, I wanted to just say, because there's another aspect of it, that Trump is going ahead and going after his enemies, and he's allowing Stephen Miller to define immigration policy to be able to, what, in some way create this white society and get rid of the so-called undesirables. But there's no regard for the economy. They somehow think that, you know, white working class people are just going to take these really hard jobs and just fill in or not. Doesn't matter, right? I don't know. Like, have you seen, and this may not just be your reporting, but like any reference to what happens to all these businesses that collapse? When I saw that car washes here in Los Angeles were collapsing, you know, these are small businesses. That's the a traditional backbone of the Republican Party. But hey, they're hiring Latinos and people of color. So
I have to confess that the economic aspect of their plans confuse me. because I do think that, you know, as long as you have a democracy where people can vote you out, you have to care about the economy. And even when you don't, right? Even when you don't have a democracy anymore, you need a strong enough economy that people don't turn against you. And from, you know, slashing government contracts and government employees, like, that has ripple effects throughout the economy, right? And tariffs, you're raising prices on everyone, right? Like, that has consequences in the economy. You want to mess with the Federal Reserve. You are playing with fire. And
not to mention science, which is an amazing growth engine of the United States.
Absolutely. And in a lot of parts of the country, the universities that are doing the scientific research are kind of like the economic engine of that community, right? Not all universities are in New York and Boston, right? So I think that their policies are incredibly economically destructive. I think we're only beginning to see, you know, unfortunately, we're only beginning to see the consequences of that. And I cannot get into their heads about it. I think there is probably, if I had to guess, some amount of unwillingness to admit that there could be very bad economic consequences because this is their mission, right? Their mission is to destroy the federal government for the most part, many aspects of it. Their mission is anti-science across the board, right? Their mission is to hollow out universities so that they are no longer power centers that could oppose them, right? Their mission is to pick favorites among corporations through tariffs.
And countries.
Yes, and right, exactly. And that's just not how you have a robust capitalist economy. I don't know, will that come back to bite them? Like, will this come to a head? I can't predict the future, but it is puzzling to me. And I just have to assume that the economic voices in the administration are basically saying, this will be fine. You know, like, we'll bring back manufacturing. We'll like, you know, have this, you know, we'll have every, all of these American, you know, I can't remember if it was Elon Musk or someone else said it, basically like, let's take all these federal workers we're firing and let's like send them to work in like the factories we're going to bring back. Right. So you, instead of, you know, people working on diseases, they're going to build sneakers. I don't know.
I didn't hear that. Amazing.
This is several months ago, but yeah. So, I mean, I think it's kind of wishful thinking, but.
It's reckless. And it's also, you know, primarily ideological, and maybe secondarily, there will be some thoughts about, you know, that you could see that in the way that Trump unleashed the tariffs when it was devastating. He backed off, as you know, in the Wall Street, I think it was Financial Times, said taco. Trump always chickens out. He doesn't always chicken out, but he often chickens out, especially when it hurts his stock market or his, you know, poor, I don't know, because we don't need to talk about this here, but we've seen how he's treating the U.S. economy as, you know, Trump Inc., you know, and enriching himself and his family over it. But I wanted to talk, you know, we've talked a lot about how we are not able to depend on the court as our ultimate guardrail here, because your incredible reporting shows how the Roberts decision enabled so much of this by granting Trump immunity while in, you know, while he's in power. So if we don't have that kind of, if we have the court silence or weak concurrence or lack of constitutional argument, you know, against what Trump is doing, you end with somewhat of a hope in your article and talk about the role of juries, grand juries, and public opinions. Do you see them as meaningful checks against all of this?
Yeah, I think I do. On the one hand, having the federal government investigate you for a crime is incredibly burdensome, right? You can spend all your savings trying to, you know, hiring a lawyer and, you know, trying to defend yourself. You can lose your job. It can be horrible. So I don't want to, it is an incredible weapon, and it is incredibly potent political weapon, because you can just sort of wave around these allegations and then discredit people and, you know, weaken your opposition that way. But at the end of the day, you do have to go before a grand jury, possibly, and then ultimately a jury, and to get a conviction, you know, or a judge, if that is the case. And at that point, you got to have the facts. Now, as my article points out, they could start falsifying the facts. So we have to like be careful here. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I mean, this, you know, we talked about the charges that the that Ed Martin and Trump want to bring against Letitia James, and the prosecutor's going, I don't have the evidence, right? Well, maybe that prosecutor or another one is going to bring those charges.
Regardless.
And then a jury is going to have to look at that evidence and throw it out, right? So a lot of damage is done in that process. But I do, you know, we are already seeing, for example, several charges against people in Washington, D.C. since the federal troops have started essentially occupying the city, have been thrown out by grand juries, right? There was famously the guy who threw a sandwich at a federal officer, and the grand jury wouldn't indict him. And so I do think that it is a check that has, and it's a really important one. And I think there's something poignant about the fact that that is because it is in the hands of ordinary people at that point, right? That our justice system pulls in ordinary people, that it's not just the DOJ and the president and judges who are running the show. It's ordinary people who are selected to judge as well. And that is right now, I think, our most powerful check on the weaponization of the law.
Well, I'm glad you're bringing this out, Pema, but I don't remember if this was in Stephen Miller or Vance's sort of vile remarks in the last week. It might have even been the FCC, but they said, you know, cross us and we'll drive you into penury. You know, in other words, we'll sue the hell out of you and let's see what kind of deep pockets you have to fight back. That was a very big threat, I think, and maybe a little, you know, they were seeing what could come from this, that people will, you know, fight, but they're not going to have the pockets to fight the way that the government does. Is that how you read that?
Yeah, I didn't actually hear that comment, so I can't, like, know specifically how I read it. But, yeah, as I said, I mean, the power to investigate and prosecute is an incredibly powerful weapon if it's abused. And it can certainly ruin someone financially, ruin their reputation. And look, I think juries are an incredible check, but, you know, you might get a bad jury or, you know, bad as in like one that doesn't work for you, right? That doesn't exonerate you. It's an incredibly powerful tool, and they know it is. And it is a tool that the Supreme Court has explicitly said Trump has, and he can do whatever he wants with it.
But we do have, and I know this goes a little bit further than your article does, but I know you've also thought about this. We still have states that are refusing to succumb, California being one of them. And so I guess the question, we haven't seen Congress standing up in a meaningful way. But do you think that that's still possible, that Congress or the states can restrain Trump?
I'm pausing because I want to make sure I understand the question. Do you mean in terms of prosecutions or just broadly, can they restrain him in any way?
Yeah, I guess that question wasn't detailed enough, but I'm trying to figure out what kind of Democratic guardrails we really still have left. Obviously, massive demonstrations are one thing because they influence public opinion, but so far they haven't. Trump doesn't seem to care, but, you know, and he's certainly gone after Newsom, you know, for standing up and when he tried to tell Texas to, you know, basically gerrymander so he can have more seats, and California strikes back and others, he's, you know, he gets really, he sees that as a threat. So it's just a question, and I know you're following this legally rather than in a sort of public protest way, but it was a broad question.
Oh, yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. Yeah, I think the states can do a lot. Like, we have a federal system, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I think we saw this recently with Governor Pritzker in Illinois, basically saying, you know, you bring the National Guard to Chicago and you violate our laws, we will prosecute you. You know, a reminder of state power as well. You know, these things are always double-edged swords, right? Like, sometimes state independence is bad. Sometimes it's a check. And so I do think all of that matters. You know, I do think like all of that is important. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the decision to cave on the parts of various people and corporations. And I think that courage inspires courage, right? And fear inspires fear, right? Winning
and victories
begets winning.
Embolden people. So, yes. You know, when you see these things thrown out, it should embolden people to go further. But I wanted to ask you too, because we're talking a little bit about what guardrails are still there, and you're giving us plenty. And I wonder, you know, certainly we want to encourage as much civil disobedience on this as possible. At least I should say that. But what does it mean beyond Trump? Assuming Trump doesn't stay in power forever until he dies, could a future president use all of these powers to, again, you know, rule, maybe even a Democratic president? We saw that with the signing statements that Bush did, and then, you know, Obama did them as well. So whenever, you know, there's something there for the president to use to increase their power, the temptation's too great, it seems. So what does this mean? And what can we do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that theoretically, yes. Theoretically, if Trump is replaced in 2029 by a Democrat, the Supreme Court has greatly grown a Democrat's powers to do all the things that it is allowing Trump to do. In reality, I think that there are reasons to think it would not work that way. Now, I don't want to say Democrats can't be tyrants. They certainly can. However, I think it is more likely that a Democrat would want to reinstate norms and, you know, sort of walk back from an authoritarian bent, but not in every way, because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, Obama certainly went further than Bush, for example, on a number of fronts, but not others, right? So Bush had the U.S. attorney scandal, right, where they were firing U.S. attorneys for political reasons, and everyone was like, oh, you can't do that. Now apparently you can. Obama didn't do that, right? There was, you know, the DOJ independence was like a very hard norm, but, you know, there were other, you know, especially in thinking national security, surveillance, you know, where Obama, you know, went just as far, further, if not further. The other thing I would just say about this is that, you know, we've just been talking about how the court can say you can't use race when you're accepting students, but you can use it when you're rounding up people and detaining them, right? So the court also, if you look at their opinions on executive power, if it's a power that Democrats are more likely to use, like issue regulations to protect the environment, they're going to strike those down more likely. If it's a power that a president is more likely to use, like let's dismantle this agency, right? Like let's stop having a Department of Education. Let's stop having, I don't want to spend this foreign aid money. I don't want to, you know, all these things. The Supreme Court is more likely to side with the president and grant that executive power. And so I do think that the empowerment of the executive is not even. It is not on all fronts, right? So it is, on the one hand, the president can, through his agencies, do whatever he wants. On the other hand, if doing whatever you want means eliminating student debt, no. If right. doing whatever you want means a clean power plan, no. Right? And so I feel very uncertain about these sort of predictions of like, well, if they let Republicans do it, Democrats will do it too, and you'll rue the day that you let Trump do this because the other side is going to do it. I'm not sure the other side will do it in the same way, and I'm not sure that the court will let them do it in the same way because they are not consistent when it comes to these questions.
Yeah, back to what Chemerinsky once said in an interview right here. He said, we need to expand the judiciary and double the size of all the courts, including the Supreme Court, and have, of course, term limits. That's a very different discussion. But I wanted to ask you finally, Pamela Levy, and I know we're running out of time, but you're a journalist and you're bravely writing about all of this stuff. It's been really chilling to see Trump come down on comedians. John Stewart did a satiric show pretending to, you know, stay within the bounds of adoration of the president. And that can certainly backfire because we can depend on comedians finding a way to make that backfire. But are you frightened at all as a journalist? What do you see as the role of journalists in this period? And that, of course, extends to others like in civil society and ordinary citizens. But, you know, let me just get your thoughts on how you operate in this period and whether or not you see any chilling breaks coming. B-R-A-K-E-S. Yeah.
No, it's a really good question. I am really fortunate that I am not feeling any pressure to, let me say that again. In a different way. I am not personally under any pressure to change what I'm going to say. And I am also very careful and always have been to say facts, and not go beyond that. But it just is a, I don't know, I'm actually thinking maybe, and let me just think about this for a second, because it is like a, it is a good question. This is a really unprecedented time, and it has me very broadly concerned about the country and about the well-being of everyone in it. I currently don't worry day to day about punishment for what I say. And I'm very fortunate to feel that way and be able to operate that way.
I think that's really good. I think we should just probably say you should keep doing what you're doing because you're doing it very well. But, you know, it's something that you usually don't have to think about, right? Pamela Levy, thank you so much for all of those observations. We're going to have to leave it there. But I wanted to let listeners know that Pamela Levy writes often at Mother Jones. That's where she reports from. She's had a long history reporting also for Newsweek, International Business Times, Talking Point Memos, and The American Prospect. And take a look at her article. It is still online. I think it just came up a day or two ago, and it's called "The Supreme Court Greenlit the President's Political Prosecutions, Even Unlawful Ones." And that's what we've been talking about. The subhead on that, I don't know if you wrote it, is "Thanks, John Roberts." And thanks to you, Pamela Levy.
Thank you very much.
That's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Pamela Levy. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer and director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gotha, and Aussie Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs as guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
This is KPFK. On Tuesday, September 23rd, we're kicking off our most important push of the season, our fall fund drive. Your donations, not corporate advertisers, are what power the progressive voices and unique programs you tune in for. We need your help to get a running start on our goal. Make your gift today, and you'll be one of the first to contribute to this critical campaign. Your contribution makes a direct impact, ensuring that we can continue our mission providing free speech radio. Please make your contribution today by visiting kpfk.org/donate.
La agencia ICE está intensificando las operaciones de deportación en el área de Los Ángeles. Pero si lo detienen agentes de la ICE, usted tiene derechos constitucionales sin importar su estatus migratorio. Si usted o alguien que conoce ha sido detenido o desea denunciar a la ICE, puede obtener más información en Chirla, llamando al 888-624-4752 para obtener ayuda legal y recursos. Es un servicio bilingüe. Para más información, visite chirla.org.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara,